Hey, just a brief update. We are with Charles Coulomb, and he's in Austria. We are in America, so our connection just wasn't that great. So there are some interruptions and some delays. If you hear those while you're listening, please just be patient. We try to clarify as we move along when those interruptions happen. Otherwise, enjoy the episode. Well, many of you asked for it, and we're here today with Charles Coulomb. And Charles, welcome. He's in Austria right now.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yep. And I really enjoyed a lot of the podcasts that have been put out, not by you, but with you on history. And we wanted to bring you on, talk about history. Maybe we can get into a little bit of economics. I want to talk about papal history, especially talk about Catholicism in America. I really liked your treatment on that. I had known about it before about Pope. Was it Pius the Ninth who sent a crown of thorns to the president of the Confederate States of America? Did I get that right?
Yeah. Jefferson Davis, when he was in prison in Fortress Monroe.
Yes. And, before we get into that, I'll introduce you. Charles Coulomb is one of North America's most respected and sought-after commentators on culture, religion, history, and politics. He is a social and political commentator of note. In 2005, he provided narration for ABC News on the funeral of Pope John Paul II. He's appeared in over 20 journals. He's written and debated politics, the abolition of the monarchy at Oxford. Is that right? The Oxford Union?
Yeah, the Oxford Union.
Yeah, in 2011. Written about rock and roll and American Catholicism and even haunted houses. So, I mean, it's a pretty impressive and broad CV you have there, sir.
Well, it's just because I've got a low attention span. I kind of scatterbrained, as you might say. I'm interested in an awful lot of things, but I get that from my dad, really.
Well, we've been talking here on TNT about a lot on Catholicism in the United States. And I want to talk maybe more about Pius the Ninth and Jefferson Davis. But what if we went back to, say, 1776? What was it like to be a Catholic in the American colonies? And in particular, what was the original stance of the Pope and Catholic Europe towards the emerging United States of America? I think a lot of Catholic Americans would be interested in that topic.
Well, firstly, you got to bear in mind a few things. One of them is that the 13 colonies, oddly enough, were settled by Britain, which was a Protestant, with a Catholic minority, which was fairly badly persecuted, the penal laws, as they were called. Now, that didn't mean that Catholics didn't manage to survive in different ways. They did. But it wasn't easy. And in fact, in all but three of the 13 original colonies, the faith was outlawed. Now, those three were kind of unusual cases. In Pennsylvania and Delaware, the reason was that the Penn family, who literally owned Pennsylvania and Delaware, they were what were called proprietary colonies. They had decreed that any Christian and the Jews would live there freely. So that meant the Catholics. And as a result, Old St. Mary's in Philadelphia was built in 1733. It was the first legal Catholic church built in the English-speaking world since James II was driven from his throne in 1688. The other colony was an interesting case, Maryland. Now, Maryland had been founded as a gift by Charles I to Lord Baltimore, who was Catholic, first Lord Baltimore. And it was a refuge for religionists. But it was not a Catholic colony. It was a colony where Protestants had equal. Well, because of the eventual defeat of James II, which I just mentioned as being driven from the throne, the Baltimores had the colony taken from them. And the Protestants took over in Maryland. It became a royal colony, and Anglicanism became the state religion. But then the fourth or fifth Lord Baltimore apostatized, and so he got Maryland back. From that time, the position of the Catholics in Maryland was slowly eroded legally. And in 1708, I think it was, the last law was about, it was to be put through the assembly, which would have made Catholicism completely illegal in Maryland, like the other colonies. But the Catholics of Maryland appealed directly to Queen Anne, who you may remember was the daughter of King James, and always felt a little bit guilty over what she had done to her father. So she quashed the law. And because she quashed the law, the Catholics in Maryland, while they still had some disabilities, they were legal. As a result, Maryland became the center of American Catholicism. Now, there were two big differences between the Pennsylvania Catholics and the Maryland Catholics. Pennsylvania Catholics were mostly Irish and German, and they were a very mixed group. The ones in Maryland were mostly English. And oddly enough, to this day, if you get down there in southern Maryland, that sort of Catholicism is still very much with us. It's very unique. It's unlike, if you've not been there, it's unlike anywhere in the country. It's worth going to. At about the time of the Revolution, a group of them moved out to Kentucky. And the area they settled in Kentucky, the so-called Holy Land, again, English-speaking American Catholicism, the like of which you just don't see. And the towns have names like Loretto and Holy Cross, things like that. Anyway, there's 1776. Now, several things had happened. The first was that George III was the first of the Hanoverians to be recognized as king by the Holy See. And there were several reasons for this. He was the first in the House of Hanover to consider himself more British than German. And that, as you can imagine, was because his grandfather and his great-grandfather were content to let the country be run by, shall we say, other hands. But George III wanted to be king, like King James, like Queen Anne. That is to say, an executive figure like the president. Obviously, the people who had been running the country were keen on that happening. In this side of the water, or, well, that side, since I'm in Austria now, you had an interesting problem, and that was that the King of England had been seen as the protector of Protestants against Catholics. Remember that the Protestant colonists had constantly been fighting the Spanish in Florida and the French in Louisiana and in Quebec. So Catholicism was the religion of their enemy. It's very, very important to keep in mind. So what happens? Well, you have the French-Indian War. My ancestors are defeated by yours, a great conquest. And all of a sudden, the king has a whole bunch of Catholic subjects he didn't have before. Now, in Britain, Luther was favorable toward Catholic emancipation at that stage. The treaty that gave him Quebec, he had sworn his new French and Indian subjects as though they were his own born. That's the word of the treaty. But now he's got a problem. All these Catholics and Indians, what are you going to do with them? By British law, the Catholic nation, and then finally by the
Quebec. Charles, we lost you for a little bit there. Did you lose him, Tim?
Yeah.
So you said the French and the Catholics and the Indians, and then you said by law, and then we lost you. If you could just pick up there.
By law, the French and Indians had to, the Indians who were Catholic, had to have their religious rights and other rights restricted by British law. But by the treaty, they had to be given their rights. So this presented a problem. Well, the result was that he put through something that eventually became the Quebec Act, 1774. For 10 years, it had been a provisional thing, but 1774 was erecting the law. Church in Quebec became established, and the French Canadians had the right to their religion, their language, and so forth. And the frontiers of Quebec were expanded to include all the French-speaking settlements in the Northwest. Well, this provoked a very harsh in the South. That is in what are now the 13 United States. Suddenly, the great defender of Protestantism against the evil Romanists became their patron. And that Quebec Act became the so-called intolerance The other thing, by the way, I neglected to mention, it's kind of important for what happens, is that there was a third group of Catholics who were living, you might say, but they're very important for Canadian history, if not America. They were in the Mohawk Valley of New York. The Mohawk Valley was dominated by the Iroquois, you know, and by a man called Sir William Johnson, who's Irish. Sir William brought over a bunch of Scots Catholics as his tenants, and with them an Irish priest called Father John McKenna. The reason why these people are important is because when the Revolution came in 1776, their Protestant neighbors drove them out of the Mohawk Valley in the dead of winter. They went to Canada, formed a militia regiment, and came back, and every year would raid their former neighbors. But their pastor, Father John McKenna, the Irishman, became the first Catholic chaplain of the British Army since James II. Because he had had to make the long march to Montreal with them. The reason why this is important in Canadian history is that these folks later, when the war was over, settled in Ontario and were part of the beginning of what we call Anglo-Canada. Anyway, I digress. So here then you have the two major groups in Pennsylvania and Maryland. 1776 comes along. What happened? Well, the Catholic community, like so many others, was divided. You've got to remember, the Revolution was a civil war. It wasn't simply a revolution. It was a civil war, a first civil war. And the if you look at who the loyalists were, it's fascinating, because they were inevitably the people who, for one reason or another, was someone on the outs.
Yeah, so usually the lower classes tended to be with the royalists, right?
Precisely.
Yeah.
The now, not always, but and remember, as with any civil war, everything now there are exceptions to on all sides. You'll always be able to find somebody who's an exception. Loyalists, as a rule, were less wealthy. They were from areas that were sort of, how do I put it, neglected. Cultural minorities, religious minorities. So that in New England, for instance, where the Congregational Church was the established church, Anglicans tended to be loyalists. But again, you find exceptions both sides. In the South, where the Anglican Church was established, the Presbyterians, who were Calvinists and the Congregationalists in New England, they tended to be loyalist. With the Catholics, what you had was a split along class lines. The wealthier Catholics tended to be for the rebels, like Charles Carroll of Carrollton. The poorer Catholics tended to be loyalist, like the members of the Volunteers of Ireland and the Roman Catholic Volunteers. And again, very much the same splits that afflicted the rest of the colonies afflicted the Catholic community. Now, an interesting little factoid for you is that the Congress, after the sent out two letters, one to the people of England, one to the people of Quebec. The people of Quebec, it asked to join them in their glorious fight for freedom. The letter to the people of England attacked the king for establishing in Quebec that religion that has drowned your islands in blood. The problem was the copies of both letters made their way to the Bishop of Quebec, Bishop Briand. So when Benjamin Franklin and John Carroll, Father John Carroll, later to become our first Archbishop of Baltimore, came up to Quebec to try to convince the French Canadians to join the revolution, Bishop Briand doing that, and he excommunicated John Carroll.
Oh, he did? Well, John Carroll? Yeah.
John Carroll. This was
what year was this?
1776.
Yeah.
So he was excommunicated.
It was John and Charles went with Ben Franklin, right? Both
Charles
cousins.
Too?
Yeah, Charles was there
too.
Both cousins were there. Yeah. I'm assuming Charles got excommunicated too. Yeah.
That I couldn't tell you, but I know John did, and this is why. Years and years later, when John was going to, he was named Archbishop of Baltimore, Bishop of Baltimore, by the Pope. And so he went to England to get consecrated in Lulworth Castle. So you might ask yourself, well, wait a minute, why didn't he just go to Quebec? Well, it's because he couldn't set foot in the province.
Right. Right.
See this, you know, during the modernist controversy in Britain, there were some people who got local excommunications. A very famous one of these was Maud Petrie, excommunicated by the Archbishop of Westminster. She couldn't receive communion in London, so she'd go across the Thames to the neighboring diocese to go to Mass. I love these sorts of bits of history. It doesn't let any of us be smug. It makes us all look bad.
So was the I'm curious about this. Was the excommunication against John Carroll, would that have been a local excommunication that wouldn't have been respected elsewhere?
Absolutely. That's the whole point of local excommunications.
Yeah.
That's my point. That's why Maud Petrie had to just cross the river and she could go to Mass.
Right.
So you could be locally excommunicated. It doesn't happen that often.
Mm-hmm.
But years ago, John communication in Quebec was lifted.
Oh, it was.
Give it back from the dead. He's welcome.
Yeah.
Charles, I'd like to break in there and have you comment, if you would, on the to zoom out a tiny bit. This is great granular instantiation of the principle, but except what people, you know, I talk about this in my book. I'm always showing people your book here. I got it, Puritan's Empire. Tons of great stuff.
Hold it up, Tim. Hold up the book. There it is.
It's an attractive cover with Tumblr House there. I'm getting the glare. Oh. Yeah. So it's amazing stuff. In my book, Catholic Republic, what I cover, I'd like to hear what you think about this. So it's really the wick. People don't know, George III was the first Tory king in, what, 70 years to sit on the throne. It was since before the Roundheads and the English Civil War and all that, it had been, you know, the Tories had been all but expelled from English rule, and George III was the first. He was the return, and it's no real surprise that the Whigs have a problem with him. The Whigs are kind of the ones to continue the tradition of the English Civil War all the way until 1688, 1689. But so you have the Tories and the Whigs in English politics hating each other. The Whigs are the guys that give us recognizable limited rule, you know, mistrust of government, you know, small, you know, no real government planning, small government and all that. The Tories are the, you know, the royalists. And then you have the Catholics and you've mentioned the sort of contingent nature of, you know, some Catholics were for the, you know, 1776, others weren't. I pitch it as, I mean, of course that's true, but I pitch it as Catholic social teaching, Catholic just war philosophy and all that makes just revolutions always the thing. So in the rare instances where they do. So it's actually the Whigs, the way I pitch it, are reading really Catholic philosophy, Catholic natural law philosophy. And the irony is between these three parties, Whigs, Tories, and Catholics, anywhere, English Catholics or American Catholics, you get a weird discomfiture because the Whigs are basically having to recur to Catholic philosophy, though, of course, they're claiming all the while that the Tories are crypto-Catholic because they're, you know, the English pretenders who they had, you know, put to death in the 1640s. And it's a really weird situation. This is replaying out 50 years, 60, 70 years later in America. Would you like to comment on Whigs, Tories, Catholicism? I mean, sure. The best way to put it, my church says Patrick Henry is more Catholic than Charles Carroll of Carrollton. And I think there's something to this. The more Whig you are, the bigger the firebrand, the more limited government, small government. That's really the Catholic spirit alive in America.
It's true. But what makes it difficult, I mean, we've heard of something very, very important, and that is the weird connects. For instance, if you look at the Civil War, you look at who the Cavaliers were, the Roundheads, and I want to recommend a book right now by a man called Kevin Phillips called The Cousins Wars. I can't recommend it highly enough because it looks at the series of conflicts in the Reformation through the English Civil War, the Jacobite Wars, the American Revolution, the American Civil War as a coherent set of conflicts. At the beginning of which the Anglosphere was a little Catholic kingdom on the edge of Europe, and ended up as the great Colossus we are now. Well, the have to bear in mind, Henry VIII, when he seized the monasteries and then distributed them amongst his supporters, he had wittingly created the oligarchy that would dominate England for the next few centuries, the Whig oligarchy.
Charles, we dropped again because of the bad connection. Can you go back to he unwittingly created the oligarchy that would rule?
That would rule England for the next few centuries, the Whig oligarchy. The strange thing is that Thomas Cromwell, who was his great assistant in destroying the monasteries, was the great uncle of Oliver Cromwell. Mm-hmm. All right. So you have, of course, Queen Elizabeth, under whom there's a long peace, as it were, between the crown and the slowly growing power of the Puritans. Now, the Puritans are an important element of this story, both in England and America. They were great believers, of course, in themselves as the successors of the children of Israel. And their opponents weren't simply their opponents, they were Canaanites. And that's something that notion runs through Anglo-American history like stripes on a barber pole. Well, anyway, what you then have happen is that James I also maintains sort of a quiet peace between these differing folk. Charles I has a major problem. The major problem by now, the oligarchy. Now, they want to do several things, not just alter the Church of England. And he, by the way, was interested in reunion with Rome and Catholicism in the Church of England. He was also against what we call the enclosures. And this is an important key part of our story. Because in England, as in the rest of medieval Europe, you had most of the land outside the towns divided up into estates that various noblemen and lords ruled, owned. But there would be commons, sections that, although nominally owned by the lord, were used by all the tenants, the peasantry, to graze their animals on. This was essential for their survival. Because, of course, they grew they ran their own little plots of land that they grew their vegetables on. But they needed to be able to graze their animals on these. The enclosures basically allowed the local lord to take control of that enclosed land and have only his sheep graze on it. But of course, his tenants wouldn't be able to make a living. They'd have to go. He could take over and graze more sheep on it. Where would the tenants go, you ask? They would go to the cities.
Yeah.
And become the foundation for the industrial mob that would one day staff the factories when the Industrial Revolution came along. So it all worked out, but in a terrible way. But this was the setup. Charles is overthrown by Cromwell. He's murdered, as we know. His son comes back and gets compromised. The oligarchs have to keep what they've got, but the king essentially playing ball more or less with them. Charles II is able to play that game fairly well. James II is Catholic. He can't. And they were willing to tolerate that while both of his daughters, his only heiresses, were Protestants. But then he remarried. He was widowed. He remarried, and his new wife gave him a son. Well, no, not another Catholic king. And so the oligarchy paved the way for the first successful conquest of England since 1066. And all the while that was going on, the colonies were being settled. And here comes an interesting point.
Charles, can I jump in with a question about that?
Of course.
So
please do. If you don't stop me, you better stop the flow.
I like the narrative. I've never heard that take with James II. So the resistance towards the heirs of James II.
No.
Was this from the lower class that was displaced to the cities, or was this more from the oligarchy that was running the lands? What was the resistance to, well, I guess Charles I, Charles II, on up through the revolution?
It was the oligarchy.
Yeah.
And they in turn, I mean, this is the mob in England tended to be Jacobite, as the supporters of the Stuarts were called. But in the late century, they sort of transitioned to being what was called radical. And these people, eventually, their descendants, so Gallien, about 100 years, would, after the Industrial Revolution and so forth, would become the roots of socialism. But their motivations, you understand, their motivations lay in the past. Anyway, so suffice to say that another book I recommend to you very highly by a fellow called Eric Gill. I think it's Gill. Anyway, it's called The Royalist Revolution. It just came out. Maybe it's Eric Nelson. Anyway, The Royalist Revolution, wherein he shows that an interesting sign of the American Revolution is that each of the colonies had been settled directly under the king. They had not been settled with reference to Parliament. This is an important thing to keep in mind. So, in theory, they had a direct relationship to the king. But then you have the Glorious Revolution, so-called, James II's overthrown. Parliament becomes sovereign. Parliament can decide who's going to be king. Now, what that meant is the colonial administration shifted to the cabinet and the government, dominated by the oligarchy and getting more and more powerful. Queen Anne dies in 1712. She's the last of the Stuarts. Her brother and his sons and all that are on the continent, the rightful heirs. She dies. She's succeeded by her cousin, George I. From this time on, he speaks no English, so he doesn't go to cabinet meetings. And the cabinet runs itself. Who dominates the cabinet? The Whig oligarchy. Who are the Tories? They're countrymen. They're the people in the west of England and the north of England. The squires, as opposed to the great landed nobility. And the odd thing is, the Whig oligarchy used the language of limited government to justify their rule. The Tories used the language of loyalism to defend their liberties. Right. And this to us, this sounds very peculiar. It sounds just the opposite of the way it should run. But you'll see, if you study these things in detail, that this kind of weird dysfunctionality goes through history. And you'll see the same things in our own day. The issues are different. But you'll see people defend abortion because of limited government. You know, I don't want the government in my bedroom. Okay. I tell you, you don't want any handouts from them. But that didn't my bedroom, but I want their gifts. I digress.
The important point there, maybe you could clarify. I mean, there are misapprehensions of limited government that can be misapplied by, you hear them by people that don't understand natural rights, as they talk like conservatives. I think it's a clever parlor trick, right? You'll hear abortionists say this. Oh, I'm all for limited government, which is of course ridiculous. These are the same people that want the government to, run everything. They want to see a federally run nanny state that decides who lives and who dies, death panels. But yeah, it could, I mean, arguably, the contingencies of history, it could have been such that, of course, the Tories had been, who had been expelled up to George III, were struggling to justify their existence in English politics, particularly after the English Civil War and all that. That's fair enough. And they had been the party with kings accused of being pretender, French Catholic loving, crypto Catholics. But I mean, it's always true to say, would you agree that the idea of, I mean, in the United States Constitution, Article 1 does not concern the president. Article 1 are those powers that involve the Congress. This comes largely from the Magna Carta principle. That the legislature is sovereign, but it really is first instantiated in England by the Whigs, right? Like you said, they're the ones in the Glorious Revolution making Parliament more higher than the king.
I'm afraid I've lost you.
Nope. Can you hear me, Charles?
I noticed when either of you begin to look funny, then the voices go. So,
and for everyone listening or watching, Charles is in Austria.
Yeah.
Tim's in California. I'm in Texas. So I think the Atlantic Ocean, the tides are somehow messing up our conversation here. So thank you for your patience.
It's the concept of the pond. Yeah. The Atlantic is the divide of the Atlantic. Is what
appropriate
we're talking
for
about
our
this.
Topic. Yeah.
It is.
We're seeing globalism struggling against geography.
Yes, right.
But at any rate, no, that's quite true. The idea of limiting the king and making parliament sovereign, as I said, oligarchy, it's important to bear in mind is that the monarchy of Britain, as it evolved from the time of Henry VIII, was itself something of a distortion. St. Thomas, of course, was a great believer in mixed government, monarchy, aristocracy. Three with the three types of government. He felt it was best to have three mixed. But this,
sorry, Charles, can you say that again? We lost you. Oh, Thomas sorry. Was a great advocate of mixed, and then we lost you. So pick up there, please.
He was a great advocate of what was called mixed government. He said, alongside Aristotle, and I have to emphasize this, but also drawing from actual experience in the way medieval monarchy ran, from Britain to Poland, the best forms of monarchy, he said, were monarchy, of government rather, were monarchy, aristocracy, and what he called polity.
Right.
Now, he said the best government would incorporate all three, so you'd have a king, you have the aristocracy, which translated to the estates, and so too you would have the commoners. And in the medieval setup, this was how it was run. The king was like an orchestra leader, and power was very diverse. Authority was concentrated in the king and the church, authority being the right to say what ought to be done. Power, the ability to make things happen, was divided amongst all the players and more that I've spoken of. Well, with the Reformation, both in Protestant and Catholic Europe, you had kind of a imbalance develop, in that power began to be concentrated in the hands of the monarch. Now, again, you've got to remember this is kind of a relative thing, because there was no monarch. No monarchy claimed the powers that our absolute democracies do today. So we always have to bear this in mind. But at any rate, and they were held back by a lot of, partly by the force of custom. So when we say absolute monarchy, you always got to say it with these things, because it really wasn't. However, it was an aberration from what the model had been. Well, what happens? The Whigs assert Parliament sovereignty. And bear in mind, too, that when we speak of Parliament, we're not talking about a popularly elected body. We're talking about a body that was only elected in its elected element by the well-to-do. So you have the lords, who are who they are, their bishops and their barons, and you've got the commons, who are elected by the wealthier members of the community. So, too, were our own colonial assemblies. Something like a quarter of each of those assemblies, the white population, white male population, could vote for each of the colonial assemblies, who levied the majority of the taxes. That's something else you've got to bear in mind. Parliament did not really levy any direct taxes on the colonies until the attempt to in the 1760s. Well, where was I going with all of this? Well, in each of the colonies, which bear in mind were very different from each other, they were very, very diverse even then. And the nature of who the oligarchs were, who they weren't, differed from colony to colony. But the people who ran the assembly were the people who basically ran the colony. And in most cases, they were the people who ended up bringing you the revolution. The four wealthy colonies in 1776 were Charles Carroll of Carrollton, Carroll mentioned him, George Washington, John Hancock, and Philip Schuyler, who was New York's great contribution. Well, in the end, Parliament, George III comes to the throne. He's the first of the Hanoverians for whom English is his native tongue. And he was the first, as was said, to glory in the name. So what does he want to do? He wants to take back not the control that James II had, but the authority that Queen Anne had had. Now, what did that mean? It meant that he was committed to ruling through and with Parliament. A number of the reasons where, I think it's Eric Nelson, but where the Royalist Revolution is interesting, a number of the anti-stamp tax-minded people began to appeal directly to the king to rule them as Charles I had done without reference to Parliament. Now, if he had wanted to, he couldn't by virtue of his oath. Coronation oath required him to rule in that fashion. And this is where you begin to see some of the problem. You have oligarchy again over here. This is where the rhetoric gets very confusing. One of the things we have to guard against, and people often do this, is saying the founding fathers this, the founding fathers, as though they were all of one mind about everything. You know, you can make the argument, you can say the founding fathers were Christian. Most of them weren't of one sort or another. But you can also argue that the leading founding fathers were deist. It doesn't make the body of them one or the other, if you see what I'm saying. So, for instance, the arguments will come up, is this a Christian country or not? You could ask, what do you mean by Christian first? But even setting that aside, it depends on how you look at it and who you look at it with. Thomas Jefferson would say no. The Supreme Court in 1892 said yes.
But the tiebreaker, Charles, goes to the appeals that had to be made. I mean, you get the same kind of dilemma when you look at Congress committee's notes. Of course, there were different factions, variant factions that were striving and whatnot. What seems to be preponderant, the way we tell by looking back, is which minority has to make an appeal to the majority, and the majority was clearly Protestant Christian, obviously. You wouldn't disagree with that. The majority is Protestant Christian. The deists were misrepresented highly in the aristocracy, particularly with guys like Jefferson. But except this, I think this can also mislead people. Most people, even most of the 56 signers of the Declaration were Protestants. There's one Catholic. There are lots of because there's this Gnostic overlap between Protestantism and Enlightenment thought. There were a lot of the Protestants that dabbled in the deism, the more Enlightenment influenced guys, but except they all had to make their appeals to Protestantism. I'm just showing there's a lot of there are reasons for making generalizations here too as well, right? I mean, would you disagree with that?
No, it's true. It's just that you've got to bear in mind that whatever you've always got to bear in mind that somebody will be waiting with an exception to shoot at you.
Of course.
It's always, and there are always exceptions there to be used. I mean, if you were to say to me, for instance, George Washington versus Thomas Jefferson, which of them was the more devout Christian? Well, Washington remained an Anglican as long, most of his life, if not all of them. Jefferson became a Unitarian fairly early on. But contrary-wise, the Freemasons will like to emphasize the Enlightenment. And Washington was a Mason. Jefferson was not. And so the Freemasons will try to emphasize the Enlightenment element in Washington's thought. The Anglicans will like to emphasize the Anglican element. And, my advice to people trying to make sense out of all this is read as many sides of these things as you can, but prepare to be confused. Don't think you're going to get an easy answer, because you won't. The best way to give you an example of that is our own time. And remember that the confusions we have today, looking at our own political scene, was just as confusing at the time of the revolution, the war, or any other time you want to point to. Want to reduce everything to simplicity. And we're sort of biased by the fact that things ended up working out a certain way. But be careful, because it doesn't necessarily go wrong, which someone rushing up with something to try to refute you with.
Yep.
And sometimes they'll have good grounds.
Charles, we've got a little bit granular there. We also have a good wide shot. What's the perspective of the papacy? I kind of know what Leo XIII and things he said, but what about popes going back into the later 18th century and into the 19th century? How do they perceive these political changes that are happening both on the continent and then over in America?
Well, for starters, that's a very good question. And the answer is that the papacy itself had kind of a bad 17th century. And you can understand that, so you can understand the 18th century. One of the things you must bear in mind is that popes counted for something. One of their great fears, and they were not unjustified by prior history, was of being reduced to being the domestic chaplain of one of the great powers of Europe. So, what did this mean? It meant, sound worse than I mean it to, but it meant that when Charles V was powerful, they, in essence, backed the French and the Protestants and the Turks against Charles V. The same in the 30 Years' War, when Urban VIII backed, in a sense, the King of Sweden, Gustavus Adolphus, against the Holy Roman Emperor, Ferdinand II. So much so that the mobs in Rome made fun of him, you know. But then what happens? That vanishes. The French become the great power in Western Europe. And so the papacy becomes anti-French for a bit. And that's why James II at the Battle of the Boyne, the Pope of the day, when he got the news, had the Te Deum sung in Rome. I'm sure if he'd known what the results for his flock in Ireland would be as a result of the Boyne, he might not have felt so sanguine. But nevertheless, this was the background. All right. Well, now the 18th century dawns, and Protestantism has gotten. Britain is obviously the major power. Now, the Holy See had never stopped hoping for the reunion of England with the Church. They did their best with Charles I. That ended up with his head. Did their best with James II. He ended up in exile. So eventually, they came on a brilliant idea, which was try to reconcile the French and the Austrians, the Habsburgs and the Bourbons, to counter Protestant influence and maybe even put the Stuarts back on the throne. So, the last male heir of the House of Stuart, the brother of the famous Bonnie Prince Charlie, was actually a Cardinal York. He became a priest. That's why the house became extinct. But Cardinal York was in charge of all ecclesiastical appointments in the English-speaking world at the time of the Revolution. Because in a real sense, under James the second, James III, and then Bonnie Prince Charlie, particularly James III, the Stuart heir was sort of exile, and all the Scottish and Irish in exile in France and Spain, they all looked to him.
Is this the so-called Henry IX?
Sorry?
Is this the so-called Henry IX?
They're very soon.
Oh, we lost you. Yes, yes. If you go, so it's this is the one, folks, when you're at St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. If you walk in the door and you turn left, there's a monument there to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you'll see their actual tomb down in the crypts. Mm-hmm. Has a crown on it. I once had the pleasure of upsetting some American pilgrims from New England by showing them. Yeah, this here you see the last three rightful kings of Massachusetts. That gave me some pretty funny looks.
Yeah. But anyway, I mean, that seems to show that the when did the cardinal die?
1807.
Okay, so that shows that the papacy up till as late as 1807 was still sympathetic, actually more than sympathetic, favorable towards the Stuarts.
They were, to a degree, and I'll explain why in a moment. They hit back the Stuarts as a result of the French defeat. Remember, the Stuarts had gone to France after the so-called Glorious Revolution. But they didn't have the French defeat in the War of Spanish Succession, 1713. Part of the treaty is that the Stuarts have to leave France. Where do they go? Rome. And they went to the Palazzo Muti, where they lived till they died out. And the popes were their patrons, really. And that's another reason why they tried very hard to get them back on the throne of England by reconciling Habsburg and Bourbon. One of the interesting things, though, that is that a lot of the Stuart supporters were Protestant, and they recognized he fulfilled with the permission of the Pope.
Sorry, Charles, you said they recognized and you dropped again.
I'm sorry.
The Protestants recognized the Stuarts.
The Protestant supporters recognized the Stuarts as heads of the king of the Church of England. The Church of Scotland,
yeah.
The Church
yeah,
of
many Ireland. Of, I mean, I used to be an Anglican priest, and I remember, you know, part of our seminary training, learning about the history of the Anglican churches. Many of the high church Anglicans definitely from Charles the First all the way up continued to recognize the Stuarts. I mean, there's the whole non-jurors, right? And they were under the oath. Non-jurors. Yeah, they were under oath to the old line, and they felt that it was a matter of their salvation that they couldn't support the new regime back in England. It's a really interesting period in high church Anglicanism.
And there's one concrete remnant of it in Rome today. And that is that when James III was ensconced in Rome, he had all of these Protestants in his court. Where do you bury them when they die?
In Rome?
You can't put them in a Catholic cemetery.
Right.
So the Pope very kindly gave James III a plot of ground, and that is the Protestant cemetery in Rome today.
I see.
That's where Keats and Shelley and all those guys are.
Oh, yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the other interesting thing about when Pope Clement XIII, who was reigning when James III died, Bonnie Prince Charlie succeeded as Charles III, but Clement XIII decided that it would be better to try to seek some sort of rapprochement with the British in order to relieve the disabilities they were under. So he recognized George III as king instead of Charles III. And when Charles III came to Rome to take over his father's property, and the rectors of the English, Scots, and Irish welcomed him as king, the Pope fired all three of them. Mm. But this is one reason why George III was in favor of Catholic emancipation.
I see.
So Charles III, Bonnie Prince Charlie, he nevertheless retained the loyalty of the non-jurors in England, and especially in Scotland. Why is this important for American history? Well, you may remember that having been an Episcopal priest, you may remember that the Episcopal Church only came together in 1789, because their organization was rural revolutions. They chose a man called Samuel Seabury to be their first bishop, and they sent Seabury to England. But in those days, the law required that you swear allegiance to the king to be consecrated a bishop.
Right. So went to Scotland.
So he went up to Scotland.
Yep.
Because there, the non-jurors there were quite happy to consecrate him a bishop because they didn't swear allegiance to George III. But those same bishops in 1788, when Charles III died and was succeeded by Henry IX, Cardinal York, Then they finally accepted George III as king.
Ah, yeah. Especially since he was a cardinal, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that and was that
he would be heirless, obviously. Well, some cardinals weren't heirless, but presumably he would go heirless. Okay, so I mean, it kind painting the picture here, it kind of seems like the Pope in Rome was opposed to the English nobility, and then even the Whigs, the whole Whig movement, even in America. And is this why the Pope would be sympathetic to the Confederate States as a counter revolution? Is that what's going on here?
Well, we'll get there. Let me quickly deal with the Revolution, and then we'll jump on to the Civil War. With the Revolution, when it first broke out, the Pope was neutral. It was a tempest outside his teapot. But two things happened. The French got involved. Mm-hmm. Now, I tell you that militarily, there were things really that allowed the rebels to win the Revolution. One was General Howe, who, for want of a better word, he was part of the Whig movement in England. And for want of a better word, he threw the battles, allowed Washington to escape time after time after time. And when he came back and took him a seat in Parliament, he had to face an inquiry. And his answer to, why did you let him go, time after time after time, was, the answer to that is political, and I choose not to respond. Okay. All right, sure. But the French intervention, which negated the Royal Navy, and then, of course, they were joined by the Spanish and the Dutch. It's interesting when you consider that the last battle of the American Revolution was actually fought in India. But at any rate, the French coming in made it a world war, and it also of the Holy See. Why? Because now there was a Catholic dog in that particular fight. Mm. And of course, the Pope supported France and Spain against England. Now, Ben Franklin had acquired a huge, huge following in France. He was a real celebrity in Europe, especially in Catholic Europe. And he played it up to the hilt. I mean, there is in Europe a certain fascination with the frontiersman. To this day, German speakers read these Western novels that were written 100 years ago by this fellow Karl May, and they'll come up to you if you ever come over and ask you if you've ever heard of Old Shatterhand and his Indian sidekick, Winnie Two. No, you haven't, because they've never been translated into American, English, and the fellow that wrote them had never been to the United States. But nevertheless, big fascination. So, Ben Franklin was a superstar in the Europe of the 18th century. So the war is over. Normally, Cardinal York would have made the appointment to be the next, because they could no longer stay under the Vicar Apostolic of London. Normally, that would have been Cardinal York's thing because they were English speakers. But the government made it clear that they did not want Cardinal York behind any appointments over here. So the Pope turned to the best-known American of his time for advice as to who to choose for our first bishop. And he chose, for the Pope, John Carroll. So someone asked him, why did you pick Father Carroll? And Ben Franklin said, well, you know, all the many months we spent together going to Quebec and back, he never once mentioned religion. Mm. In a way, that's kind of how we Catholics have gotten along in the States ever since.
Right.
Got us a president of the White House. What's not to like? But seriously, from that time, of course, because of the French and Spanish intervention of the Revolution, which had begun with this heavy anti-Catholic element, it certainly couldn't stay that way. And interestingly enough, there were pictures of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette up in the Independence Hall with a congressman until they were executed. And you'll be interested to know that Carlos III, founder of Los Angeles, I always have to point that out when I mention him, he also endowed, I know, Tim, I know, it's a little LA goes a long way, I know. But anyway.
It's the Angelino in you. Yeah.
Well, the New Yorker in me is proud of the fact that the first Catholic church was Carlos III. And that's where Mother Seton would be converted years later. Anyway, as I say, the papacy recognized the new state of affairs very, very quickly. And that's one thing you find about papal diplomacy. It's extremely pragmatic. Sometimes in ways we really wouldn't like. But it's important to remember that they usually don't see things the way laymen would. And now I'll give you an example of what I mean, because this comes up again and again and again in history, especially in history since the French Revolution. You basically have either a political or a military between the Catholic laity and the anti-Catholic government in a given place. All right. It's a big fight. The clerics say to the Catholics, rally, defend the church. They defend the church. They jump up and down. When it looks like they're on the point of winning, inevitably, their anti-Catholic opponents will go around the heads of the lay leadership, the clerical leadership, and say, you know what? You call off your dogs, and we'll give you about a fifth of what you originally asked for. And then the clerical leadership, just to do their jobs, say, okay, we'll call them off.
Yeah.
Usually it doesn't end very well for the laity involved. It generally doesn't work out too well. And I'm afraid that that's a pattern that you see over and over and over and over again. But it's not something that can be fixed. And it's not because one side is good and the other bad. Over now, I'm very much aware of Cardinal Menzenti's, the Hungarian, his cause for canonization, which is moving along very nicely. Think about him, though, and you, neither of you are probably old enough to remember it, but I remember when Pope Paul VI, Cardinal Menzenti, who'd been in the American Embassy in Budapest ever since the 56th Revolution, Paul VI basically ordered him to give in and leave the country.
Yeah.
Well, you can look at this, and for the layman, this seems like a horrible act of dishonor, like a betrayal, like all sorts of things. There's the other side of it. The other side of it was he was able to fill vacant dioceses and vacant parishes. And people who hadn't had the sacraments in many, many years were able to get them. And semi-half-normal church life was able to move on. I don't know if you know the book Chivalry by Léon Gautier. But he has a sentence in there that I've never forgotten because it illustrates the eternal struggle here between the layman and the cleric. He says, speaking of the Middle Ages, but he says, the priest was disgusted by the knight's cruelty, and the knight was disgusted by the priest's placidity. Hmm. Now, if you change knight to lay activist,
yeah,
you see, it makes perfect sense. It's like the battle between the sexes. It's not something that you can solve because it's something you have to live with, work around, deal with, accept, compensate for. And it's not that the one side are evil and the other good. It's just that this is the way they are. And they have their own vision of things that you understand.
Hmm? Charles, let me jump in here. So the difference in treatment between Puritan's empire here, which I've read select chapters, just excellent, and your treatment and, say my book, Catholic Republic, is basically history versus philosophy. And whereas you're seeing the contingencies in with great alacrity, great clarity. The contingencies is like the top of the ocean. I tend to see more, I want to get your response to this. I tend to see more of a unifying theme, like deep beneath the ocean here, even though, of course, papal politics are nasty. They've always been sort of nasty, or at the very least, pragmatist. And you see in the late 1700s, a kind of vague acceptance of the new Catholic, the new American Republic, based on, you know, contingent loyalties like that to France. What an easier look at this, not an ahistorical one, but a more 30,000 foot look at it would be, look, the principle of subsidiarity, the prime social principle, wins out because it's fundamentally unjust, even violative of nature, for one land across the Atlantic Ocean to be governed by England, right? This is anti-subsidiarian, if there's ever such a thing. And I find by the time you get to the Civil War popes, the popes during the late 1800s, up to and including, say, Leo XIII is the last one, he was so, what a lot of, I think, Americans don't understand is the profound love that Leo XIII had for the American experiment. And it's because he loved his Thomism, right? It's precisely because of that three-branch rule in America that was being tried out for the first time. Montesquieu's experiment was, I think Leo XIII saw it as a near, not a perfect, but a very nice instantiation of Thomas and Aristotle's mixed regime, right? Leo XIII said so. This is how mixed regime works. You see an executive in the president, the polity in the legislative and the aristocracy in the judiciary. Right. I mean, what would you say to that? There's a lot of profound love by the time you get to the Civil War popes for the American experiment.
Let's move a second, though, if we may, because I'd have to say to you that when you speak of subsidiarity in that sense, looking at the revolution, you're kind of reading back into it things that the people around didn't really have in mind.
Certainly.
I have to emphasize also, I'm not a philosopher. I am an historian. I'm not really much of an abstract thinker. It's, you know, one of the reasons I've come to this wonderful institution I'm at is to acquire a chunk more of philosophy and theology than I've had. I thought someone was bringing something in, like a drink or something. I'm getting parched. Anyway, fine. Be that way.
Yeah, it's too early in the morning for that.
Danishes? Can we pass Danishes through the screen?
Now that would be good. I'm getting hungry. I'd even settle for Mongolian barbecue. Oh, sorry. That was a topic.
I still owe Charles Mogos, my favorite Mongolian barbecue. Place in the San Fernando Valley went out of business 6 years ago, and I'd promised it not knowing this.
I'm sorry to tell you this, but this is your first go around. The rest of your life is going to be filled with the good old places shutting.
Yeah, I wish
I had a happier. Anyway, but seriously, again, you have examples. I mean, I know it's perfectly correct to say that the United States were the first example of mixed government by any stretch.
No, not the first.
In fact, one of the arguments that the Founding Fathers made initially was that they were trying to return Britain to its original constitution. Again, that was prevalent. I mean, just like others, you had appealing to the king as the heir of Charles I. Then you had Thomas Paine, who was a very interesting character. He was the first one, to my knowledge, to come up with the idea of saying, well, the children of Israel had judges and God didn't like them because they wanted kings. He made that argument, and then he laughingly told John Adams that it was all very funny since he didn't believe in the Old Testament anyway. Thomas Paine is not one of my favorite characters, but there you are.
No, me neither. One of the worst of the founding. Yeah.
Well, I want to go back to our first few minutes here. But Tim, how can you say that the Civil War popes were great lovers of the American experiment when Pius IX is sending a crown of thorns, not to the president of the United States of America, but to the president of the Confederate States of America?
Again, the Pope, that, I mean, they had great understanding, not of slavery, which is, you know, probably exaggerated in the minds of many people out there, right, in terms of how it played out. If you see the conflict of states' rights, you know, states' rights, of course, was as the South was claiming, the conflict of subsidiarity was the conflict of localism. And of course, the top heavy federal government, it's unfortunate that the contingency of history dictate that the issue ended up being slavery, which is morally evil. But the Southern, you know, states, namely Virginia, the great Commonwealth, you know, four of our five first presidents came from Virginia, and they all the great Federalists, all the great anti-Federalists hailed from Virginia or the area around Virginia and New York. But in the South, it was Virginia. And there's this great Southern tradition of subsidiarity. The landed aristocracy was agrarian, and there's a beauty to that was utterly never understood in the Northern colonies and the early antebellum Northern states. And arguably Pius the Ninth is deeply sympathetic there.
Yeah, so is Pius the Ninth honoring agrarianism, subsidiarity, states' rights? What is, when you send the head of a state a crown of thorns and you're basically saying you're a suffering Christ, that's how I read it, what are you honoring? It's a mixed signal, and I don't know how to interpret it as a Southern American.
Well, firstly, let's step back a frame. One of the interesting things, at least to me, is that if you look at the 13 original states, all right, and where they stood on the matter of secession. Now, one of the things I should tell you about my history is that in the preparing of it, I read a ton of local histories, lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of local histories. Why? Because patterns emerge when you read a lot of local histories. You see the same kinds of things in little town over little town after little town after little town. They all blur eventually, the things come out. Well, what I've come to realize is that in the North, the areas that had been loyalists at the time of the Revolution tended to be Copperhead during the Civil War. But in the Southern of the 13 colonies...
By which you mean Scotch-Irish?
Well, no, not just, some.
Okay.
I mean, German, Palatine, Anglican in New England, I mean, they varied. Okay. They varied. This was what I was saying earlier when I was going on about how diverse each of the colonies had been. They were. And this is one of the things that makes pulling patterns out of this stuff so hard, frankly. But you'll see the areas in the North... in the northern of the 13 states, been loyalists. During the Civil War, they tended to be Copperhead, which meant they were against going to war to keep the South. It didn't necessarily mean they were pro-Southern. It meant they were against fighting a war to keep the South in. Contrary-wise, in those states, so the Southern 13 that had been loyalists, they tended to be Unionist. Places like West Virginia, Tennessee. It's fascinating to see, and you say, well, why is that? Well, it seems kind of obvious to me that in all three cases, when they were loyalist, when they were Copperhead, or when they were Unionist, depending on where and when you're going, it was the same thing. The people who were already in charge, already home, they didn't particularly like, come and offer them a chance to shed their blood for a glorious cause that they had no interest in. So you don't generally get a good response to that kind of thing. You know, come join me in the fight for gay rights.
No, thank you.
No, I can you include me out on this particular? Next time I'll be with you, but not now.
But the other issue is that the I have to get this in. There's nothing more American than the concept of secession. Ideological based secession, localism and secession. And Jefferson wrote from the White House in 1801 that he said the issue of American happiness matters not whether we be two unions, one, or I think he said four. He might have said 13. The point, I mean, he's saying this 13 years after the ratification of the Constitution, the new Constitution. The point being that really, if you look, when people read the Constitution and they see everywhere states, you know, the S's are capitalized, this means head of state, sovereign international immunity principles. You know, the idea was imperium in imperio, an empire within an empire. And what we were trying, the federal system of state governments really being the sovereigns, we have Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution saying that the 16 meager things the federal legislature, the Congress, can legislate on, which ended up being violated in terms of the Civil War. It was an overreach the same way, you know, when the states were no longer able to be sovereign. They happened to be wrong morally. But there is a federal overreach, much the same way the British government was overreaching across the Atlantic, trying to tell. The idea is if the 13 states are sovereign, you know, local rule, which is holy, according to Catholic social teaching, then there's something deeply American there that was uniquely recognized in 1776 in the American experiment. And my whole point in saying all this is that what Charles is saying about there aren't good guys and bad guys. I don't agree in the case of certain wars. He wasn't even saying it in the context of all wars. But nowhere is it more starkly the case than in the Civil War, where, yes, slavery is a horrible, horrible issue. We wish we weren't talking about that. But it was also a conflict over states' rights. Maybe even first most, it was a conflict over states' rights, which is very American. So the Confederate States of America were not shedding their Americanism. So Pius IX could have sent this crown of thorns as a sort of benevolent nod to subsidiarity. That's how.
Well, I got to tell you, I certainly don't agree with you. I don't disagree with you, I mean to say. They sound so similar. I don't agree with you. I don't disagree with you. And that's so different. I don't disagree with you as regards the Civil War. My native state of New York, where I was born, they only signed the Constitution on the proviso they could get out if they didn't like the deal. But having said that, there were other things at play. In Europe, don't forget that the conflict between Catholicism and quote-unquote modernity that in Europe starts with the so-called Glorious Revolution and all that, where the Jacobites oppose the union of crowns. In other words, I mean, that's today they have a wonderful phrase for the English Civil Wars because they were also being fought in Ireland and Scotland. They call them the Wars of the Three Kingdoms, which I think sounds very Tolkien-esque. But the French Revolution, the subsequent Carlist Wars, the Miguelist Wars, and Portuguese, amongst other things, were fought between and the all in favor of local liberties. Now, that had continued, and this is, I'm trying to get you into the mind of Pius IX now. That had continued, those particular conflicts, first militarily and then politically, into the 1860s. Two other things were happening. Italian and German unification. Mm. That's Prussia and Sardinia smashing and gobbling up the little countries that they were in. Now,
see the flag behind you for details, right?
What's that?
See the flag behind you for details.
The flag behind you will tell you something.
Yeah.
This will tell you about the Quebecois side of things. This side will tell you about Austria.
Yeah.
You can meditate on it if you like. But seriously, the centralization piece was certainly very much on the Pope's mind because he himself was directly fighting it.
Yes, I see now with a unified Italy is akin to a unified America.
Exactly.
And this is starting to shed some light here. Yeah.
And one of the things that you will see about the Civil War, I mean, we can argue the American side of it, but in terms of how Europeans looked at it, they tended to see it in terms of their own struggles at home. And again, I recommend the Cousins' Wars for coverage of Britain about this, because the areas of the British Isles that have been Jacobite tended to favor the areas that had been Whig tended to favor the Union. In France, the Legitimists tended to favor the Confederacy, and the Orleanists and all them tended to favor the Union. Spain, Carlists versus the Isabelinos, same. Well, so Pius IX finds himself in the middle of what, in his mind, is a similar struggle. That having been said, though, and this is an interesting thing, the first clash between the papal armies and the Sardinians was in 1860. I wrote a Wabs, the volunteers who came from all over the world to fight for Pius IX. And many of them came from having lost the sorts of struggles I've been mentioning. And they saw fighting to be a way of continuing it, just as many of the same sort of people went to fight for the Confederacy. But he had a large contingent of Irish troops in the initial battles in 1860. They defeated. The central Papal States are taken over by the Sardinians. He holds out of the area around Rome. The Irish are basically on guard duty with nothing to do. John Hughes, the Archbishop of New York, comes to Rome to try to get Pius IX not to recognize the Confederacy. He really isn't successful, but he does get the Pope's permission to recruit any of his Irish that want to go fight a war. And so off they went to fight for Lincoln. And one of them, the celebrated Major Keogh, not only fought through our Civil War, but ended up dying at the Little Bighorn. Mm. He was the second in command of Custer. When the Indians were busy mutilating the remains, they came to Keogh's body. They saw his papal decorations for gallantry, and because a number of them were Catholic, instead of mutilating his body, they buried him. But, there you go, that's life.
Benefits.
So, at any rate, as far as tonight, I'm sure that he saw this, even as you said, in terms of the same struggle for local liberties as against centralization. Now, on the other hand, the Tsar of Russia, Alexander II, who had just liberated the serfs, saw Lincoln, especially after the Emancipation Proclamation, as the great apostle of freedom, as he himself was. So where the British and French supported the Confederacy, the Tsar supported Lincoln, and he sent Russian naval squadrons, both in San Francisco and New York, to underline that support. Here's the fun zinger. Karl Marx supported Lincoln. So this was a time where you saw the Tsar and Karl Marx on one side. So, not that means anything philosophically, but my point is that the foreign element into our Civil War, they read it in terms, and we all do this, but they read it in terms of their own struggles that were going on. And I'm not saying that they weren't entirely applicable either, because, you'll see that American history does tend to parallel European history in strange ways. In a lot of ways, you could say Jackson was our Bonaparte. And our Civil War, which was certainly the bloodiest, nastiest conflict we ever fought, paralleled very much the wars of German and Italian unification. You could even say, if you wanted to, that FDR was our Mussolini, which the then question would be, well, why is it that ours, with the exception of the Civil War, are generally less bloody than their European counterparts? And that's a whole other argument. It could be that we're just very nice, or that we're never so deeply opposed to one another that it goes that far, except in the Civil War. And if you think about it, one of our major accomplishments, to my way of thinking, is that 50 years after that war was over, as horrible and disgusting and bloody as it was, and you go to the battlefields today, and even now you can get a real sense of it. You know, you go to places like Corinth, Mississippi, and Petersburg, Virginia. It was miserable. But 50 years later, they were able to have the reenactment in Gettysburg with not reenactors, but the old men who fought the fight.
Yeah.
And the old Confederates came toddling down the hill right into the arms of the old Union vets. No other country on earth can I think of that such a horrible thing could be papered over so quickly. Now, you might make the argument, Tim, and I would not be in a position to dispute you, the argument that reconciliation was bought at a great price.
Sure.
I'd be hard put to say you were wrong. But at the same time, I'd have to say it's an accomplishment.
Sure. Well,
it wasn't Ulster.
Yep. Well, good. This is a good place to stop. We've kind of run over a bit, but this is really good. And it reflects on theology and diplomacy and history and ecclesiology and all these things. So it's really important. Hopefully we can do this again.
Sure.
Certainly opened my eyes to a lot of things I hadn't seen before. So, Charles, thanks for being on. We really appreciate you taking time from Austria.
Yeah.
Happy to do it. Now, when you see me in the flesh again, perhaps I'll be speaking with a thick Viennese accent.
There we go. Work on that. Work on that. Quite sophisticated.
There's Mongolian barbecue in San Diego. I know a place, so we'll have to go a bit south, southerly. But I'll make good on that promise.
Not only will I collect on it, but we'll have lunch or dinner there, and the other meal of U.S. Grant. I'll introduce you to the wonders of mock turtle soup.
Sounds amazing.
Fair enough. All right. Well, everybody, thanks for watching. Pray the rosary. Stay close to Christ. Please like and subscribe this channel. And we appreciate everyone. God bless. And until next time, signing off.
Peace.
Peace.